middle of the road out of nowhere, blocking our way. She had dark hair and flawless ivory skin, and was dressed in a silk sheath dress in emerald green, setting off huge green eyes. She must have been about my age, and she was more beautiful than any girl I'd ever seen before. She also had way more bling. Strapped to her head was a tall gold crown that burned in the endless afternoon sunlight. Her ears were covered by giant, jewel-encrusted poppies that looked like really fancy earmuffs. As soon as they saw her, Indigo and Ollie dropped instantly to one knee. Indigo grabbed my arm and pulled me down with her. "Dearest people of Munchkin Country," the girl was talking to us as if she were addressing a huge audience, except there was no one else here. "I am pleased to announce this auspicious day for all of Oz, a day when sadness bids its final farewell and joy begins its eternal reign. By royal order, under punishment of death, I hereby declare happiness henceforth." Indigo sighed in disgust and rose to her feet just as the girl was starting her speech all over again. It was like someone had set her on repeat. "Dearest people of Munchkin Country," the girl cried again. "It gets me every time," Indigo muttered. "Just ignore her," she said, noticing my confused expression. "Come on." "It's not real," Ollie explained, standing too. "Just a recording. You come across them every now and then, to keep us in line. I bet it means we're getting closer to the Emerald City, though." "Who is she?" I asked. "That's not Dorothy, is it?" "It's Ozma, Oz's true ruler," Indigo said. "She's still technically in charge, but no one's seen the real Ozma outside the palace in ages. It's always just these illusion things. Look." She wound her arm up like a pitcher and went to slap the girl. Her hand passed easily through the princess's head. "See? Fake. The real Ozma doesn't care about us anymore." "I am pleased to announce this auspicious day for all the people of Oz," Ozma kept babbling. Ollie looked away from the hologram like it hurt him to stare at her even a second longer. And then Indigo stepped right through her, and we all just kept on walking. Ozma's canned speech faded slowly away into the distance. "We waited a long time for a ruler like her," Ollie sighed. "She was supposed to be in charge all along. She's descended from the fairy who gave Oz its magic. But she was just a baby when the wizard came here, and he didn't want her getting in his way. So he sent her off somewhere. Then, when he left, he made the Scarecrow the king. That didn't go well." "The Scarecrow was evil too? Like Dorothy?" I asked. I was having a hard time keeping track of all this, but something about it seemed important. "No," he said, and then chuckled ruefully to himself. "Not then, at least. He just wasn't a very good king." "He wanted to sit around the palace thinking all day," Indigo cut in. "If you ask me, brains aren't all they're cracked up to be. Anyway, everything went to hell until Ozma came back." "Where was she that whole time?" "No one knows," Ollie said. "She would never talk about it. But she has fairy blood, which meant she had a right to the crown. It's deep magic. Since she was finally of age, no one could do anything to take it away from her." "Dorothy did," I pointed out. "Not exactly," Ollie said. "Ozma was in charge for a long time," Indigo said. "Things were good with her. The best. The sun rose and set on time. There was magic everywhere. The monkeys flew wherever they wanted while Ozma reigned," Ollie interjected. "It was what Oz was supposed to be all along," Indigo said. The funny part is that when Dorothy came back, everyone was happy at first. She was a hero, you know. And nothing changed for a while, except that she moved into the palace. She and Ozma became friends. They did everything together. No one even minded when Ozma made her a princess, too. It seemed like she deserved it. And then? Then came the happiness decree. After that, we stopped seeing so much of Ozma. It was like all Dorothy all the time. Ozma was just gone. You think Dorothy did something to her? Indigo nodded. I don't know what, she said, but Ozma would never let this happen to Oz. She must have been tricked or...
Or she's dead, Ollie said.
No! Indigo nearly shouted. She can't be dead. Dorothy's not powerful enough. No one's powerful enough. Once Ozma had the crown, nothing could take it away from her. It's fairy magic. That's the strongest there is. Nothing can break it. Nothing can kill her. Ollie didn't look so sure.
What if the magic's gone? He asked.
Indigo didn't answer him. The whole time they'd been giving me a primer on Oz's history, which I still wasn't sure I understood, we'd been walking. And now we had come to a wide, stagnant river. The water was mossy and still and rotten-smelling, and had a toxic green tint to it. At the muddy bank, a tangle of thick black vines twisted like snakes. Luckily, we didn't have to swim through that muck. As it neared the water, the yellow bricks began to ascend, stretching up and out into the air in a meandering path. There was nothing supporting them, no cables or columns or beams, and the whole road swayed and fluttered back and forth like a ribbon in the wind. I gulped. "Are we supposed to cross that?" I asked. Heights weren't exactly my favorite thing. But the height was the least of our problems.
Monkeys,
Ollie breathed, pointing at the tiny silhouettes that swooped and dove against the newsprint gray of an endless cloud that hovered just above the road.
They're patrolling the bridge.
I laughed nervously. Time to turn back, I guess. But I knew we couldn't. Where would we go? We had seen what there was to see back there. The only direction was straight ahead. Indigo looked up at the monkeys in thought.
I think we can make it past them, she said. I know a spell that might work.
Wait, I said. You can do magic? You didn't tell me that. Indigo cocked her head and raised her eyebrows like she was offended.
My grandmother was a sorceress, she said. She may not have been as powerful as Glinda, but she taught me a thing or two. She would have taught me more if Dorothy hadn't banned it. But the winged ones are more susceptible to magic than almost anyone. I think a misdirection charm will get us past them.
She closed her eyes and raised her hands, moving her fingers in front of her in rapid, fluttery movements. I looked down at myself, waiting to see what would happen. Was I going to turn invisible or something? But nothing changed. After a minute, Indigo opened her eyes.
I think we're good to go, she said. Just don't talk. Don't do anything that will attract attention.
I don't think it worked, I said.
It worked. Misdirection's not that powerful, but it will do the job. It won't hide us from them totally. It just makes us easy to overlook. They'll simply be distracted every time they look in our direction. Trust me.
The thing is, I was having a really hard time concentrating on what she was saying. But I got the idea. Crossing the flying road was like trying to walk on a breeze. It rippled and dipped and swayed back and forth, and every time you lifted your foot, you had to wonder if there would be anything under it when you put it back down. Ollie was fine. He went scampering on ahead on all fours as easily as if we were still on solid ground. Indigo didn't have too much trouble either.
She was so squat and compact that it would take a wrecking ball to knock her over. But I was neither a monkey nor a munchkin, and I had to stretch my arms out at my sides and consider each step carefully. I didn't look down. I just kept my eyes on the road, the bricks yellower than ever against the dull gray of the sky. Well, I tried to. Unfortunately, it's hard to keep your eye trained on a moving target. Every time the narrow swath of road shifted, it revealed the water a million feet below us, and still as menacing as ever. I didn't know which would be worse, the fall or what would be waiting for me underneath the surface of the nasty, slimy river. With every step, I wanted to panic. I wanted to sit down in the middle of the road and hug my legs to my knees and give up. But I didn't do any of those things. Tornado or no tornado, a girl from Kansas doesn't let much get to her. So I set my fear aside, put one foot in front of the other, and as the road carried me high into the sky, I felt myself becoming less and less afraid. I wasn't going to let anything as stupid as a breeze or a few wobbly bricks knock me off my feet. That's what it means to be from the prairie. It was something I had in common with Dorothy. I knew exactly how high up I was when I felt my fingertips scraping clouds. After my dad left, my mom and I would watch Wheel of Fortune every night after dinner. I wasn't very good at it, but my mom always guessed the answer before the contestants. At the end of each episode, Pat would thank their sponsors, and as he reminded us about the joys of flying the friendly skies, an airplane would drift across the screen, bound for sunny Aruba, or fabulous Orlando, or wherever, floating in slow motion across a sunset pink landscape of fluffy clouds. I didn't like the idea of airplanes, and I didn't really want to go to Orlando anyway, but I'd always wondered what it would be like to touch a cloud. Now I knew the answer to that, at least when it came to Oz clouds. It turned out they were just as soft and fluffy as they looked on Wheel of Fortune, as solid as cotton balls, but they were nothing you'd want to curl up and take a nap on. Every time my fingers grazed one, it sent an icy shock up my arm and down my spine into my toes. Some of them were as small as party balloons, and others were as big as couch cushions. And soon they were so thick in the air that I had to swat them out of my path in order to keep moving. Meanwhile, I could hear monkeys screeching, getting louder and louder. They were so close that I could feel their wings flapping just inches above my head. Every now and then I'd hear a scream so loud it straightened my spine. The sour smell of monkey breath filled my nostrils. But Indigo's spell had worked. They were close enough to touch, but the monkeys were ignoring me, acting like I wasn't even there. Finally, the road began to curl in on itself, rising up in a steep, tight coil until I came to the top and stepped onto a small circular platform twice as wide around as a hula hoop. This was the top. I was so high up that even the monkeys were beneath me now. It was all downhill from here. Literally. On the far edge of the platform, the yellow road plunged back toward the ground at a steep, straight incline, the rough texture of the bricks suddenly slick and smooth. It was a yellow brick slide. But that was nothing in comparison to the sight on the horizon. The Emerald City had come into view. Nothing I'd seen so far had prepared me for it. It seemed to have come out of nowhere, just when I was least expecting it, and now that I was looking at it, it was hard to understand how it hadn't been visible all along. With its swooping skyline that was so green it colored in the sky around it, and the palace with towers so high that they disappeared beyond the clouds. From up here, looking down on the city in the distance, you could almost forget everything that had gone wrong here. From up here, you could almost pretend that this was the Oz that should have been. But as much as I would have liked to have stayed up here forever with that fantasy, I knew the monkeys would spot me eventually if I didn't keep moving. I gulped, looking down. "Just pretend you're going down a water slide at Aqualand," I told myself. It might have made me feel a little better if I'd ever actually been to Aqualand. My mom had never taken me. So I just took a deep breath, dropped to my butt, and reassured myself that going down had to be easier than coming up. If nothing else, it would be faster. I closed my eyes and pushed off. My stomach dropped as I hurtled downward, the wind whipping across my face and gaining speed every second. At first, I was terrified, but after a minute, I inched my eyes open and saw the clouds whipping by as the ground approached at high velocity. Feeling a rush of exhilaration, I opened my mouth to whoop with joy and caught myself just in time to remember that the monkeys would hear me. Instead, I let out a quiet little squeal, grinning from ear to ear. I landed with a thump on solid ground, where Indigo and Ollie were waiting for me, both looking a little shaky. "That was actually sort of fun," I said, scooping myself to my feet and dusting myself off. Indigo glared at me. Ollie looked away, and I instantly realized my mistake. He wasn't thinking about the slide or the thrill of survival. He was thinking about the monkeys. I wondered how it had felt for him to be so close to his people and to not even be able to look at them. The monkeys weren't evil. They were slaves, and some of them had probably been his friends once. Were his parents and his sister up there somewhere? Had he recognized any of the voices that had cackled in his ears? "Ollie," I said, "I'm sorry." He shook his head like it was no big deal, but when he finally spoke, it was through gritted teeth, and I could tell he was angry. Maybe not at me, but it didn't really matter. "I would do anything to get them back," he said quietly. "Is there anyone in your life like that? Anyone you'd do anything to help, no matter what?" I bit my lip and hesitated. There was a time when I would have said my mother. Now I wasn't sure. I had tried to help her so many times, had done everything I could possibly think of, and none of it had worked. Not even a little. Now she was probably dead. "I don't know," I finally said, feeling my face flush with shame. He cocked his head like he didn't believe me. It wasn't the answer he had expected. Indigo just rolled her eyes. "I feel sorry for you," she said. "I really do." We didn't say anything after that. We just trudged on ahead. But I couldn't stop thinking about the question Ollie had asked me. I made a decision, a promise to myself. I couldn't help my mother anymore. If I'd ever had a chance, it was long gone now. But if I ever had a chance to help the monkeys, I would take it, no matter what it cost me. It was the least I could do. Not for him, but for myself. Just to say I had someone. When the road turned a few minutes later, we found ourselves in an apple orchard. The trees were lush and green in contrast to the icky cornfields. Huge red apples dangled temptingly from their branches, shiny and juicy-looking. I stepped off the road, the grumbling in my stomach outweighing what I'd seen with the mutant corn. Star, still in my pocket, knew what was up, too. She poked her nose out and chirped hungrily as I reached for a piece of fruit. For a split second, I thought I saw the tree blink. I snatched my hand back. I looked at the talking monkey next to me, remembering that anything was possible here. Did that tree just move?
They talk, too, but they've taken a vow of silence.
Voluntarily?
The princess felt that their conversation ruined the apple-eating experience and was therefore a violation of the happiness decree.
What about their happiness? The trees, I mean.
I think we all realized a little too late that the only happiness that matters is Dorothy's,
Indigo chimed in.
Ollie looked at me. I know you want to, but you can't.
Is it poison? Or is it forbidden?
It's against the happiness decree. It's not worth the risk, Indigo said.
But we need to eat. And Ollie needs his strength. No one is around.
I plucked two apples and nodded at the tree, meeting its sad eyes.
Thanks, I said.
I handed one to Ollie, who took it and examined it, unsure. The first bite melted in my mouth. It tasted like pie, apple and cinnamon and sugar and butter all mosh-pitted around in my mouth. It was a magically delicious apple. Finally, something in Oz that was actually as cool as advertised. It was too good to last. I'd just taken another satisfying bite when I saw Indigo's face go white. She pointed behind me and opened her mouth to say something. No sound came out. And then it started to get dark, but it wasn't the sun setting. The sky was as sunny as ever. Instead, it was like the world around us was being covered in shadows, starting with the yellow road. Then the shadows began to rise up from the ground, curling and inflating and twisting into forms. They were taking on shapes. Shapes that looked oddly, eerily familiar to me. It was the Tin Woodman. He wasn't alone.
Chapter 8. I knew we were really in trouble when I saw that Indigo was too scared to even mutter an "I told you so." She was just a little wall of fear with wide eyes. The color seemed to drain from her tattoos until they were just gray impressions on her skin. Ollie was shaking right down to the tip of his tail, the uneaten apple still in his hand. This Tin Woodman was not the Tin Woodman I remembered. By now, I shouldn't have expected anything different. Nothing was the way it was supposed to be in Dorothy's remade Oz. Still, I wasn't prepared for what I was looking at now. He looked more like a machine that had been cobbled together out of spare parts, a hodgepodge of scrap metal and springs and machinery pieces all held together by screws and bolts. His long, spindly legs were a complex construction of rods and springs and joints, and bent backward at his ankles like a horse's legs. His face was pinched and mean, with beady, flashing metal eyes and a thin, cylindrical nose that jutted out several inches from his face and ended in a nasty little point. His oversized jaw jutted out from the rest of his face in a nasty underbite, revealing a mess of little blades where his teeth should have been. I half remembered the Tin Woodman's story. He had been a flesh-and-blood man, until a witch had enchanted his axe to make him chop off pieces of his body one by one, and one by one he had replaced them with metal parts, until that was all that was left of him. From what it looked like, he had been making improvements ever since. The only thing that was really familiar about him was the funnel-shaped hat he wore. I guess some things never change. Behind the Tin Woodman, four people in black suits materialized out of the shadows a moment after he did.
They weren't made of tin, but they weren't exactly people either. Each of them was mostly flesh, with a few mechanical modifications. One of them had a silver plate bolted to his face where his mouth should have been. Another was round and squat, with huge copper ears the size of his entire head. The third was a girl, probably about my age, with a glinting sword in place of an arm. But it was the last one who was the creepiest. He was just a disembodied head grafted to the body of a bicycle, with two robotic arms where the handlebars should have been, the knuckles of his mechanized hands scraping the bricks on the road. "Run," I said. It came out as more of a breath than a word. But no one moved. There was nowhere to run to. And anyway, I was so scared that my knees felt like they were made of jelly. I tried to smile my widest, most ass-kissing smile, the one I usually used on Dr. Strachan at school. When I remembered that it had never worked with him, I made it even wider. If anyone noticed, they didn't mention it.
"In the name of Ozma of Oz," the Tin Woodman said grimly, his voice robotic and scratchy. "By order of Princess Dorothy, I, the Tin Woodman of Oz, Grand Inquisitor of the Emerald Police and Commander of the Tin Soldiers, hereby arrest you for crimes of treason."
He held out a piece of paper with a gold seal on it, and for the first time I got a look at his hands. A chill ran through my entire body. He had fingers like knives and needles, each one of them twisted into a slightly different shape, like dentist tools. I had avoided cavities my entire life exactly because I'm not good with pain. My body tensed up, anticipating one of those sharp things pressing into my skin. "Treason?" I squeaked. At the Tin Woodman's words, Ollie, who had been frozen at my side, suddenly came to his senses. He began to screech his ear-shaking monkey wail, and he sprung into the air like he'd been shot from a slingshot. Hooking his tail onto the branch of the nearest apple tree, he used it to pull himself up into its leafy boughs. It all happened in an instant. I got one last glimpse of his tail as he swung into the next tree and then disappeared into the orchard completely. As he went, Bicycle Body reared on his hind wheel to chase after him, but the Tin Woodman put up a calm hand.
"Let him go," he said. "The lion knows the movements of all the beasts. He will take care of him. He won't make it beyond the forest."
Ollie had gotten away. He had abandoned us, if you wanted to be technical about it, but I didn't blame him. For a second, I almost wanted to cheer. I hoped he made it far, far away. I was happy about it, but Indigo and I didn't have that option. And we were in big, big trouble. She had been right all along. There were consequences in Oz, super-sized consequences that didn't fit the crime. If Ollie had been tied to a post for sass, then what would our punishment be? I wanted to tell her I was sorry. She had warned me, begged me even, and I had ignored her. But was I sorry? Should I not have freed him? I didn't think so. What else could I have done? It had been right to free Ollie. But was that what we were really being punished for? Her frozen face broke, and she collapsed to her knees, sobbing.
"Please," she sputtered through her tears. "I was trying to help Dorothy. I was bringing the traitor to be interrogated. I swear, I just wanted to help. I can give you information."
She was betraying me. She had to, of course, and I didn't blame her. This was on me, and if her pleading helped her, then at least one of us would get out of this. I knew that, but still, it stung to listen to her selling me out.
"Is that so, little one?" the Tin Woodman asked coldly. "You were delivering the Outlander to your princess?"
"Of course," Indigo pleaded. "I love Dorothy more than words. Why would I ever betray her when she's made me so happy?"
I had to help her. Since I wasn't from Oz and didn't know all of Dorothy's rules, maybe they'd be more lenient on me. I stepped forward. "She's right. She had nothing to do with any of this." Indigo glanced at me now. I think she seemed grateful, but it was hard to tell. The Tin Woodman looked her up and down for a second, and then nodded to the man with the plate over his mouth. The plate slid open to reveal a spigot-like device that telescoped outward in Indigo's direction.
"What are you doing? I was the one who took the apple. I was the one who freed the monkey."
The words tumbled out wildly. Whatever the thing was that they were pointing at Indigo, it looked like it was going to hurt. He grumbled to himself as if he didn't owe me any explanation.
"Save your confession for Dorothy, Outlander. Loyalty is very important in Oz. The Munchkin must be punished for her cravenness."
"She just told you she's been loyal to Dorothy."
"Perhaps, but she was not loyal to you. Either way, she is guilty of the crime."
"What are you talking about? You can't have it both ways. Either she's guilty of being disloyal to Dorothy, or she's guilty of being disloyal to me."
"Indeed."
The Tin Woodman's metal face somehow managed to look smug.
"Now, for her punishment."
The gun-like nozzle extended from the tin soldier's lips. It twisted and pivoted, adjusting itself as he put Indigo in his sights. She was heaving and shaking on her knees.
"Run!"
I said again.
"Run!"
I cried, willing her to get up. She didn't listen. She didn't even open her eyes. The tin soldier fired, and the device made a popping sound. A tiny sigh of desperate relief escaped my lips when I saw what came shooting out of his mouth. A stream of iridescent bubbles.
That was it?
I wanted to laugh as the innocent-looking bubbles floated toward Indigo, zipping forward in a happy little stream. They began to swarm her like bees on honey. But instead of popping when they touched her, they clung to her clothes and skin. She swatted at them frantically, but it was no use. They didn't budge. My eyes widened in horror as the bubbles began to melt into her flesh. I made a move forward to help her, to do anything, but before I could get to her, sword arms' blades snapped out at me. She pressed it tight against my jugular.
"I'm sorry," I told Indigo. "I'm sorry."
She looked at me then.
"No. You were right. Please help us," she said. "You're from the other place. You're like her. You can do something."
A calm look came across her face. Too calm, like goodbye calm. Then the bubbles covered her face, too. As they merged with her body, her tattoos separated from her skin and slipped off her, the ink puddling in a shiny mercurial mass. Indigo was melting. She was barely recognizable now. She was just a big lump of sticky, pinkish flesh, her arms and legs only barely discernible as limbs, her features only little misshapen blots where her face should have been.
"Make it stop!"
I begged, still crying.
"Please! I didn't mean to... I didn't know! She shouldn't pay for what I did! Please!"
"I hate to burst your bubble," the Tin Woodman said with a sly grin, But ignorance is no excuse. You can tell the whole story to Dorothy. The princess is curious about you.
Pop.
All I could see of what had been Indigo was a red splatter of bone and blood where she had knelt just a few seconds ago. I felt myself gagging, but nothing came up. I leaned over, hands on my knees, trying to get a breath. She had painstakingly written the history of the world on her body so that it would live on, and the Tin Woodman and his goons had just erased her with the push of a button. "It's very messy, but we find it's a deterrent," the Tin Woodman said.
This place was insane. He was insane. I thought they'd given him a heart. How had he become this?
"Now, as for you," I heard him saying. It sounded like he was talking to me from the end of a long tunnel. "The princess is very interested to meet the girl who dropped out of the sky." "Take her," he told his men. I didn't resist as they grabbed me. I didn't say anything. I couldn't say anything. Everything went black. I became a shadow, like them. Chapter 9. We were standing in the middle of the road, and then we weren't. The world blurred before me for a second in a swirl of colors. I blinked hard, trying to keep from getting dizzy, and when I opened my eyes again, I was standing on a glossy marble floor. I looked up. The Tin Woodman and his metallic backup band were standing beside me. We must have traveled by magic. The room we were in was the biggest I'd ever been in. It was bigger than my high school auditorium that doubled as a gym, and where there should have been a ceiling, an ever-shifting kaleidoscope of rainbows formed a majestic dome, casting a shower of vivid colors down upon the pair of gold and emerald thrones that sat majestically on a raised dais. On every wall, stained glass windows seemed to tell a story. I knew most of it already. It was the story of Dorothy. There was Dorothy's house in the cyclone. Dorothy walking down the road of yellow bricks, arm in arm with her famous friends. Dorothy facing off with the Wicked Witch of the West. They all went on like that. The last panel showed Dorothy kneeling as a girl I recognized as Ozma placed a crown on her head. But where was the one that explained what happened after that?
"Don't speak until spoken to," the Tin Woodman was saying brusquely, and I realized that he was talking to me. "And don't look Her Highness directly in the eye."
I felt nauseous. He had just killed my friend, and now he was giving me an etiquette lesson. I had never seen anyone die before. I'd thought it would leave me scared, but now all I wanted to do was fight. More than anything, I wished to put my fist through the Tin Woodman's face, or worse. But I was no match for him, let alone him and his whole death squad. If I tried to lift a finger against any of them, I knew that the last thing I would see was one of Dorothy's sick, sad, phony rainbows. It wasn't worth it. The Tin Woodman either didn't notice my anger or didn't care. He was too busy lecturing me.
"And for heaven's sake, stand up straight. The princess deserves respect."
With that, he overcorrected his own already perfect posture and frowned at something on his metallic arm. It was bubble splatter. Indigo splatter. I swallowed hard, fighting my gag reflex as he used a little blade from his Swiss Army fingertip to scrape it away with a look of private satisfaction. Just then, a flourish of trumpets began to play out of nowhere. The Tin Woodman and his men bowed down awkwardly, all except the one on wheels, who just bowed his head.
Their metal limbs creaked as they kneeled. I rushed to kneel along with them. I kept my eyes trained steadily on the ground. With a few clicks, her shoes appeared right under my nose. They were bright red high heels, at least 6 inches tall, and made from the shiniest leather I'd ever seen. Or maybe they weren't shiny, exactly. They didn't reflect the light as much as they seemed to shine from within. I heard a thumping sound beside me. It was coming from the metal shell that was the Tin Woodman.
"Well, look who we have here," a sharp voice said. "Go ahead. Stand up."
I took a breath and rose slowly to my feet to face the owner of the shoes. She was both exactly and nothing like I could have imagined. This was not the same girl I'd read about. She was wearing the dress, but it wasn't the dress exactly. It was as if someone had cut her familiar blue-checked jumper into a million little pieces and then put it back together again, only better. Better and, okay, a little bit more revealing. Actually, more than a little bit. Not that I was judging. Instead of farm girl cotton, it was silk and chiffon. The cut was somewhere between haute couture and French hooker. The bodice nipped, tucked, and lifted. There was cleavage. Lots of cleavage. Dorothy's boobs were out to here, her legs up to there. Her face was smooth and unblemished and perfect, her mouth shellacked in plasticky crimson, her eyes impeccably lined in silver and gold. Her eyelashes were so long and full that they probably created a breeze when she blinked. It was hard to tell how old she was. She looked like she could have been my age or years older. She looked immortal. She had her hair pulled into two deep chestnut waves that cascaded down her shoulders, each one tied with red ribbon. Her piercing blue eyes were trained right on me. I knew I was supposed to look down like the Tin Woodman had instructed. Instead, I found myself falling into her gaze. I couldn't help it. Her eyes didn't look evil. They looked curious and almost kind, like she was just trying to figure me out. She was so pretty that it was hard to imagine she was responsible for Indigo's death or any of the other atrocities I'd been told were her fault. As we stood there, face to face, the Tin Woodman creaked back up from his bow and began to speak.
"In the name of Ozma of Oz," he said, "by order of Princess Dorothy, I, the Tin Woodman of Oz, Grand Inquisitor of the Emerald Police, present..."
Without looking away from me, Dorothy flicked a flawlessly manicured hand at him, and he shut right up. She cut him off in a bored voice.
"Let me get a look at her. What is your name?"
"Amy Gum." My voice came out louder than I had expected. It sounded like it belonged to someone else. I tried to inhale as shallowly as possible as she walked in a slow circle around me, the heels of her shoes clack, clack, clacking against the green marble floor. As she examined me, I noticed out of the corner of my eye that while I'd been focused on Dorothy, two more people had entered the room. I knew them both instantly. In one of the thrones, the larger one, sat the girl I recognized from the hologram, or whatever it was, back on the road. It was Ozma, looking dazed and vacant. Her eyes were open, but no one was home. I wondered if this was really her, or if she was just another illusion. At Ozma's side stood a tall, thin man dressed in a baby blue, one-size-too-small suit. Beneath a small hat, Bits of straw and yarn stuck out in every direction. His face was a skein of tightly pulled burlap with two unnervingly lifelike buttons sewn on in place of eyes. His lips were thin lines of embroidery stitched in pinkish-brown yarn underneath a painted-on red triangle for a nose. His buttons were fixed right on me. A chill shot through my body. It was the Scarecrow. Like the Tin Woodman, he had been twisted and warped into something I hardly recognized.
"Now, Amy," Dorothy was saying, "this is very, very important, and I need you to be completely honest with me."
She casually began to amble over to the empty throne next to Ozma's, where she sat, tossed her head, and crossed her legs. If I hadn't read the story, I wouldn't believe that she had ever lived on a farm. She had shed that girl long ago and replaced it with a poised, haughty princess. Her neck stretched upward as if she were searching for the perfect light. Her voice was perky, but there was a threat lurking somewhere in there, too. I steeled myself for whatever she was going to ask, getting the distinct impression that she would be able to see through any lie.
"What do you think of my hair?" she demanded.
She ran a long red nail through one of her curls.
She had to be kidding.
"Well?" she asked. She wasn't kidding. My life was about to be judged by how sincerely I delivered a trivial compliment. Luckily, I had a lot of practice with humoring popular girls. Madison Pendleton had taught me well.
"It's so pretty," I said sweetly. "And so shiny," I added for good measure when she looked unconvinced.
Dorothy smiled and clapped her hands together and leaned over to Ozma with an expression of deep confidentiality.
"Ozma likes my hair, too," she said in a stage whisper.
Ozma just stared straight ahead with an unchanging expression. Feeling like I was on a roll, I decided to keep going. Maybe flattery would get me somewhere. For instance, the hell out of here. "I've read tons about you. I saw the movie like a million times." Dorothy beamed.
"Really? What do you mean?"
"Oh, you know," I replied shakily. "You're like an icon where I come from." Suddenly, she narrowed her eyes at me.
"And where exactly is that?" she asked.
"Kansas," I said. "The United States." Her face instantly darkened.
"Kansas," she said slowly. "You're from Kansas?"
"You've heard of it?" I asked, a hint of unwise sarcasm creeping into my voice. I knew it was the wrong thing to say, but I couldn't help myself. It's my greatest weakness. I never can.
"And how did you get here from Kansas, Miss Gum?" she said sharply.
"Well," she arched an over-plucked eyebrow and cocked her head, waiting for my answer. In my pocket, I felt Star wriggling, and I squeezed her tightly, hoping that she would get the message to calm down. I had a pretty good feeling the princess wouldn't take kindly to the fact that I had brought a rodent into her royal court. Star cooled it, thank goodness, but she had momentarily distracted me, and now Dorothy was waiting for her answer. She cleared her throat testily.
"What brought you here, Miss Gum? Don't make me repeat myself."
I knew I should have made up a lie. But what was the point now? I had a feeling they knew more about me than they were letting on anyway. It was probably the only reason I was alive, and Indigo wasn't.
A tornado, I said, mustering a smile. The hairs on the back of my neck were standing at attention. Inside the pocket of my hoodie, I felt Star quivering. I was pretty sure they didn't know about her, at least.
Why, you little liar, Dorothy spat. How dare you?
I opened my mouth to lie, an actual lie this time, to say that no, I hadn't come from Kansas at all. It was too late. Dorothy's face was burning with aggrieved rage.
I am the only one. There can only be one.
My gut twisted. I understood. We had the same story. It was like we were wearing the same dress to the prom, only it wasn't a party. Dorothy thought her landing here was fate, that it made her special. Another girl from Kansas meant that it was just a regular occurrence, and that she wasn't special at all. Or worse, that I was here to take her place. I did my best to scramble, trying not to trip over my words.
Your Highness, I'm just a regular girl from Kansas. I'm nothing like you. You're a princess. Look at you. Me, I'm not interested in that. I just want to be myself. I'd never want anything that you have.
I was only trying to placate her, but as I spoke the words, I realized they were true. I didn't want anything Dorothy had. I didn't want to be anything like her. Dorothy hooted in derision.
More lies. If you come from where I come from, all you do is want. And if you had even the smallest taste of what I have, you would never stop wanting.
She tapped the tip of one of her shoes as if to illustrate her point.
There can only be one. She repeated through gritted teeth.
Dorothy rose to her feet. Her face was pinched with barely suppressed fury.
Take her away, she said.
The Scarecrow turned to her.
Your Highness, he said in a calm, soothing voice, maybe we should let the Tin Woodman review the charges against her first.
The Tin Woodman pulled out his stupid piece of paper and cleared his throat to read aloud, but Dorothy wasn't having it.
Take her away!
Her scream reverberated up through the room, ringing in my ears. Her face had turned a deep red, and her fists were clenched so tight at her sides that they were vibrating. My legs buckled inward. I felt like I was watching the whole scene unfold from somewhere far away. From my new, distant vantage, I searched myself, looking for any shred of the strength and anger and stubbornness that had always served me so well, for any secret weapon buried deep within that could help me out of this. I found nothing. I collapsed to my knees, shaking. No one else in the room even flinched.
Amy Gum of Kansas, the Tin Woodman said calmly. You will be tried for your crimes of treason 1 week from today.
For the first time, Ozma acted on her own accord, letting out a high, lilting giggle. Dorothy's eyes were still drilling through me.
If found guilty, the Tin Woodman said, you will be sentenced to a fate worse than death.
Chapter 10. My prison cell was a perfect cube, all white, without a speck of dirt anywhere. The walls were white limestone, freshly scrubbed, and the tiny bed in the corner was all white, too. As soon as the Tin Woodman had slammed the cell door behind me after shoving me inside, the door had simply disappeared, like it had never existed. I pressed myself against the cool, smooth surface of the wall where it had just been, searching for a crevice, a seam, any sign at all that there was a way out, that there had ever been a way in. I didn't find anything. There was, however, a window in the room. It was no bigger than a foot wide, and it neatly framed a little swatch of the starry night sky. So Dorothy must have finally decided to let the sun set after all. When I stood on my tiptoes, the glittering green vista of the Emerald City was barely visible, poking up into the blackness. To get to this dungeon, I'd been escorted down what had felt like hundreds of stairs. It seemed impossible that there could be a window all the way down here, deep in the bowels of the palace. But there it was. It had to be magic. Was it the stairs that were just an illusion, or the window? And why was there a window in here anyway? It seemed unlikely that my captors would care whether or not I was comfortable. Well, it was clean. And there was a view. That comprised the entirety of my prison's luxuries. When I sat down on the bed in the corner, I found it hard as stone. That's because there was no mattress to speak of. The bed felt like stone because it was stone. I sat there trying to think of what I was going to do next, while at the same time trying to suppress my mounting sense of panic. Meanwhile, Star was investigating, sniffing the walls, clawing at the floor, probably searching for an exit or maybe just something to eat. She wasn't having any luck on either count. When she saw that I was awake, she abandoned her quest and jumped up onto the bed next to me. I tried to keep my eyes open. I could sleep when I was dead, and if I didn't want that particular sleep to come very soon, I had to find a way out. But I was too exhausted. I didn't even really know how long I'd been awake for. Before I knew it, I was out. When I woke up, the sky outside my window was still dark. For how long, I wondered. Dorothy controlled the sun in the sky. According to Indigo, she basically controlled time itself around here. How was I ever going to escape power like that? Star, I said, we are completely and totally screwed. On top of everything else, I was becoming one of those people who talked to their pets. I'd barely been here a day, and I was already starting to feel insane. In desperation, knowing it would do me no good, I stood and banged my fist against the wall until it was throbbing with pain. I tried to move the bed to the window, but it was rooted in place. When that didn't work, I jumped up and tried to grip the edge of the window to hoist myself onto the ledge. I just hung there limply. I had never been an athlete, and, unfortunately, I was never going to become one, even under pressure of death. I screamed. I screamed until my throat hurt. It didn't get so much as an echo in response. It was like the walls absorbed everything I could throw at them. My whole body felt like one big bruise. But none of this was doing any good. I was just wasting energy. I lay down on the bed to think, and soon I was asleep again. When I woke up and saw that the moon was still shining through the window, I finally realized why they had put the window in here in the first place. It was there to make me go crazy, to keep me guessing about how long I had been here, to give me hope that there was some way out. I turned around with a start at the sound of a key in the door. Wait, what door? But then it was there again. A thin black line began to appear out of nowhere, a black rectangle that drew itself along the blank white wall. Even after all this, I still felt a little thrill at seeing magic in action. But then the door began to swing open, and that thrill was instantly gone. I wasn't sure who wanted in, but whoever it was, I knew it wouldn't be anyone good. I was on my feet, my fists clenched. If I was going down, I was going down fighting. The face I saw a moment later as the door disappeared into the wall was so unexpected that it took me